Now on The Finest. The team reflects on the most fascinating subjects we've covered so far, and we revisit the show's most viral and controversial clip with the musician featured in it. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time for KPBS Midday Edition. On today's show, a breakdown of Prop 50 and a new art exhibit exploring San Diego's lost communities. I'm Jade Hindman with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. We'll hear analysis from political scientist Rick Epps as ballots reach your mailbox. Then, a panel of guests join us as we turn our conversation to an art exhibit from the African American Museum of Fine Art and what it reveals about San Diego's Black community. That's ahead on Midday Edition. So ballots are out, the fight for redistricting is underway, and Prop 50 is in the hands of voters. The measure would reshape California's congressional districts in an effort to offset Republican moves to gain seats in Texas. In August, we talked to California State Senator Akilah Weber about why she supports the effort. Take a listen.
Unfortunately, these are not normal times, and California, along with the rest of the nation, but California is really taking a beating from this administration. And we have to at least allow our voters the opportunity to stand up and do all that we can do.
Well, joining me live is political scientist Rick Epps. He's taught at San Diego State, UCLA, and UCSD. Right now, he's a professor and academic senate president at Imperial Valley College. Rick, it's great to have you back on the show.
Good to see you, Jane.
Yeah, so remind us how Prop 50 came to be and how it would work to counter Republican efforts in Texas.
Well, originally it came up in 2016, and it was an effort to confront first it was accountability issues with regard to gerrymandering and holding our legislators accountable when they did things that were inappropriate. This current version was based on the reality that of what took place in Texas, which is unprecedented normally to redistrict but prior to census, right? Because usually when the census comes, you redraw your districts. And this isn't just new to Texas either. This happened in North Carolina. Politically, people have been using gerrymandering forever. And it's a sort of a slick way to stack the deck in your favor. So if you have a certain demographic of people, whether they be African Americans or Hispanics or so forth, that if you don't want, and their numbers are growing in your district, and they may tend to disagree with the political norm of that district, they can simply move the address a couple of blocks to the right or the left, and then that changes the power structure of that group of people. And so that's how it starts.
Now, would you describe what we're doing here in California as gerrymandering?
It is. And I don't say that because I'm thrilled about that. Gerrymandering should never be the case. I'm a big fan of nonpartisan redistricting, which is what we currently have. I've been in politics for a very long time, and it's unfortunate that if anybody thinks that the people in politics are altar boys or altar girls or whatever, that's not the case. You have to, unfortunately, deal with the ugly realities that people will unfortunately seek advantages. I don't think that Governor Newsom is looking at this issue and thinking, well, haha, I got you. I think he's very disturbed by the process of what he's trying to do. And with the California Citizens Redistricting Commission, the CCRC, handing off this, which normally is responsible for redistricting, handing this potentially off to the state legislature, it's a very hard push. But I would also agree with Akilah that it's a very potentially necessary push, recognizing that it's only temporary. Like, they're only talking about doing this for the next, well, it starts in 2026 if it's approved. It'll end after the redistricting in 2030. So you're talking about a 4-year window. So it's a temporary stopgap to help mitigate what happened in Texas.
Mm. How many seats could Democrats stand to gain if this passes?
They could gain up to 5 seats, and that's pivotal in terms of politically. And again, it's built to try to help, you know, break down the partisanship that would occur if we don't do this. If we don't do this, then we slide further toward the conservative Republican side of the world. And I'm not saying that, again, I'm not denigrating the Republicans or conservatives for that, in generally speaking.
Is that what we're sliding more towards, though?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's you know, for me, the idea is equity, right? You try to find a balanced system where you know, everybody gains a little and everybody gives up a little. But we have slid a long ways in the opposite direction in our representation. And because of all the issues we talk about politically, you know, dealing with legislature, and that's, you know, there's a lot of money involved, lobbyists, these people who are basically buying the system. And that's been going on for a long time. There's been many pushed discussion about, you know, dealing with the lobbyists in, you know, in D.C. and also in California and other legislatures. It's a problem, and it dictates a lot of the political outcomes that sometimes ultimately hurt the people, where there's not equity. Everybody's not saying, hey, can we just get along and find a balance? Somebody's saying, "We this is how we view the world, and this is the way we want to carve it out, and everybody's going to follow the rule." Mm-hmm. That's not the way our system was supposed to be built, and this is a little stopgap to try to change that.
So I keep hearing terms like autocracy, dictatorship, as in terms of the way the country is sliding.
Yeah.
Would you describe it that way? And do you see this ballot measure as a way to stop that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Aristotle was the first person to define different types of systems. And, you know, when you look at the world we're in right now, you know, people like the word democracy because it makes them feel good. But I tell people all the time the German Democratic Republic of East Germany was called a democratic republic, yet it was not a democratic republic at all. We like the term democracy, but we really don't operate that way. We really are more of an oligarchy. And oligarchy is defined as rule by a few in the interest of the rulers. And so, you know, which means that if you have multinational corporations or rich individuals, they control the politics and power of the system. So, you know, and I'm actually working on a paper right now, a white paper on authoritarian democracy, because I really feel like that's kind of what we've slipped into, and not just in our country, but across the globe. There are a lot of countries that are becoming much more heavy-handed with their approach to how they treat their citizens and taking some of the power away. And a lot of it's based because the citizens don't understand politics or power because they're not taught it at a younger age to help understand that. When I grew up mm-hmm. in middle and junior high school, we called it civics, and everybody had civics class. So you started learning, you know, at an early age. And now I get students all the time that come in at 17, 18, 19, 20 years old who have no base of knowledge about these issues, yet they're charged with voting on things that they have no concept of.
Well, and speaking of understanding things and making sure folks have a better concept of things, you know, a lot of us are being inundated with Prop 50 ads on television. What do you make of those ads and the rhetoric being used?
Yeah, it's unfortunate that people, you know, manipulation is one of the key forms of power that we play with today to influence people, because the very definition of power in the political world that I live in is the ability to influence. And so if I manipulate the influence where I tell the white lie, if you would, right? I'm not telling you maybe necessarily a complete lie, but I only tell you the part I want you to hear so that I can get you to vote or think a different way. And that's typically what we see, is that we allow for these half-truths or even misinformation to be put forward. And to me, it's unfortunate, because what it does is it allows for those who have power or seek power to control the sort of sociological mindset of the country, even if the information is wrong. And unfortunately, there's a lot of news organizations today that are holding their nose and allowing for these individuals to not – they will let them tell the lie even if they know it's a lie. That's the part, and that's where the credibility of the news organizations has really been hit. Even for the ones that are credible, because the narrative of those that aren't, they're kind of thrown in, you know, the baby in the bathwater. They're thrown in with everyone else because people see the ones that are misleading people and are pushing that narrative and saying that all news is fake or all news lies. And so it's unfortunate, mm-hmm. because there are some excellent news people out there who do have reverence for for providing real information.
So where would you then suggest voters get credible information to know what they need to know about this measure, and also credible information so that they know whether they're hearing lies that have been unfiltered and truth?
Well, there's a couple of places that I like. I mean, honestly, KPBS does a very good job of this. I think they do a very decent job. I will stay off the MSNBCs and CNNs of the world, but I will say there's a couple of websites they go to. Fact Checker, for example, is one of the really cool websites to be able to. I tell my students, you want to see what's going on? Check Fact Checker, because it'll tell you, you can put in a Prop 50, it'll tell you the pros and cons, it'll tell you what you know what's true and not true. If your legislator says something that about a certain position on it, you can verify it immediately. So when you can, and to me, for that, I tell my students, so sometimes you have to confront truth. So if somebody's telling you, for example, if somebody said, you know, that smoking is bad, but they're getting all their money from, you know, smoking industry, well, then you have to decide, well, perhaps they're not the right person, right? I think by trying to give them sites that are nonpartisan and that are reasonable and respectable is where I try to land for them to get information.
All right. And, of course, you can always head to kpbs.org for that credible information.
Yeah.
We'll leave this conversation here, but continue on. I've been speaking with Rick Epps, professor and academic senate president at Imperial Valley College. Still to come, Rick Epps is sticking with us as we talk about the forces that disperse San Diego's Black community and efforts to bring it together. We're back after the break.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Welcome back. You're listening to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. You know, San Diego once had a very large, thriving, tight-knit Black community. Over the years, though, many Black San Diegans moved away or were forced out of their neighborhoods as a result of policy choices and other forces of displacement. So what happened to San Diego's Black community? Why did it disperse? And what do we know about the community that once existed here and the community that's here now? Well, my next three guests have seen firsthand how it's changed over the years. They're here to talk about their own stories, the Black community story of resilience, and current efforts to revitalize that sense of identity. I'm joined now by Rick Epps, professor of political science at Imperial Valley College, Gaidi Finney, the executive director at the San Diego African American Museum of Fine Art, and Cherie Jones, founder of the nonprofit Black San Diego. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jay.
It's so good to have you here. Anybody know where you can find a good plate of soul food?
Let's see.
It's the number one question.
That's always a question.
On the Facebook group, yes. Black San Diego.
Yes, they want some good food. Yeah. Yes.
Still question marks out there, I see. But
there used to be one downtown, right by Horton Plaza across the street, and then it disappeared now. So
that's the norm here in San Diego.
Well, you know, Rick, you know, people might not know this, but La Jolla once had a pioneering Black migrant community. And your family were a major part of that legacy. So tell me a little bit about your family's story.
Yeah, my great uncle came out in the mid 1920s, and he actually was a laborer from Arkansas, helped build the La Valencia Hotel, and there a lot of the black workers lived down in La Jolla Village that worked for the rich whites in the up in the mountains, up in the hills, and so my grandfather came out in like 1932 after my father was born, and by himself and. Because my uncle said, hey, there's some jobs out here and you can come make some money. So he came out and moved to La Jolla. In fact, he rented a place that was owned by Bishop School right on Draper Avenue. And then subsequently bought two or three other properties in La Jolla. In fact, at one point he owned like four pieces of property in old La Jolla. But like most of the blacks that were there up through the 1960s and 70s, even to the 80s, they didn't really know what they had. They didn't know the value of their property. My father was the first black student body president of La Jolla High School in 1947. Was an excellent student, was an all-city football player, track star. But imagine being at La Jolla High School in the 1940s and being the student body president. That was a significant thing at a time when there were still covenants. So, for example, if you were Jewish, they had a covenant. When you came out of Bird Rock, before you stepped into La Jolla, it had a sign that said you were entering a covenant zone. Mm-hmm. And if you were Jewish, you were not allowed to buy in La Jolla, even up through the 1950s, early 1960s. And blacks were not allowed to buy property across Pearl Street up until the late 1960s, early 1970s. My grandfather had a friend who actually quietly got the loan for him to buy his last property on the other side of Pearl Street. And so it was a long history. And there was tremendous, as a kid growing up, seeing all these old black folks, they would say, oh, you were one of Epps kids, and those kind of things. But it was a really beautiful, thriving community. There were a lot of Hispanics in the community as well. And there's only maybe one or two African-American families and one Hispanic family that still have the original property that they had from back in that time. Most of them were diluted or bought off. In fact, the La Jolla Light newspaper wrote a big article about this many, many years ago about the disappearing black population. Mm-hmm. And, now you look down there, it's all yuppies and all redone with fancy condos and stuff. So it's really no longer the beautiful. Yeah. The only thing that's still there is Prince Chapel, the church that my grandparents and great-grandparents is still there right off Pearl Street. That's
it. Yeah. Well, and tell me this, because you spent part of your childhood in La Jolla before moving to Lemon Grove and La Mesa.
Yeah.
What was that transition like? How was that experience different from growing up in La Jolla?
Well, kind of coming out to the country, people rode horses on the streets. It was a very different reality.
Oh, wow. It was like that, huh?
Oh, it was like that. Seriously. Okay. Very seriously. All on Federal Boulevard near College Grove was all like people riding horses. But a lot of those people had never seen black people before. It was really interesting to be
what
in a place.
This
is like, I'm going to date myself. So this is like 1965, 66, 67 in there. They had never, ever. And so the neighborhood was, where we moved to, there were about five or six black families, my father was a bank vice president for a bank that was now part of B of A now, Security Pacific National Bank. There were doctors and lawyers and psychologists. So the blacks that first came to that neighborhood were all professionals. And then they had what was called white flight. So white folks went, uh-oh. There goes the neighborhood, and quietly started moving away, and then sold their properties off to more working class black families, which was a really interesting dynamic because the population of kids coming in were very different than the population of kids that we were a part of. Our parents expected us to go to school and be respectable. And the next group came in, this is toward the civil rights movement time, was not nearly. There was a different group of kids, and they didn't really like us, and we didn't really like them because, we had different raising properties that caused that. But it was a very different place to grow up, and a lot of racism. People driving down the street would call you the N-word. It was a different world.
Yeah. Well, Cherie, you were part of a military family that came here in the 80s, right?
Correct.
So tell us about your upbringing and where you grew up.
So I grew up in, when we first got here, I lived in Paradise Hills. I was really young. I was really young growing up in the 80s, so I don't have too much memory of that. But by the time like 90s came and I got a little older and we lived in Paradise Hills, I just remember it being, everything we did was Black, to be honest. Like, we still had the Martin Luther King parade that came down Imperial Avenue. It was in the parade. We had a lot of different, like, the Cooper family would have their year-round, you know, events. But I just remember everything my mom took us to, and then I ran track for the MLK Blasters. So everything, my world was Black. But then now my kids have a different experience here in, like, 2025 growing up.
What did you observe that sort of changed that tight-knit community that you grew up in?
To be honest, I think I was too young to really capture what was exactly happening. But I think being older and like really looking at everything, I think people just kind of left. They moved away. They wanted something different. And it just kind of like we became more spread out. And then everything just, like, the Candle Street Fair was a thing, and it's not there anymore. So I just looked at one day that the things that we used to do, we didn't do anymore. And it was never like, okay, we're just doing something different now.
Yeah. Rick, you've got something to say.
I was going to say, just in conjunction with that, so when I was growing up, you had a lot of, Ocean View was like the place, right? Everybody hung out at Ocean View and Imperial. Gentry's Barbershop was there. Mm-hmm. Huffman's Barbecue was right there. You could eat, you could go get a hot link and go get your haircut, right? And then what happens is they started building the freeways. Mm-hmm. So the freeways segmented the community. Like Logan Heights was chopped up by the 5 freeway, the 94 freeway. They started breaking down these communities, which again caused for further, you know, for people to start moving further away. And then they started moving into like Lemon Grove, La Mesa, Encanto, Skyline, that all, which used to be predominantly white, became, even in Lincoln High School area, if you go back to the early 60s, late 50s, was very diverse. The communities just started being segmented. And that's where the start, I think, of the sort of breakdown of the community.
Yeah. Well, Gaidi, I got to bring you in here because speaking of the impact of these freeways, you know, last month you launched the exhibit San Diego's Last Neighborhoods, and it chronicles the story of historically Black and Latino neighborhoods that were lost to freeways and redlining and other forces of displacement. What's the story behind the exhibit?
It's interesting because I was in New York working on, you've heard of the Hollywood Walk of Fame. So the San Diego Museum of Fine Art has a project called the Harlem Walk of Honor. And we were recreating the Savoy and the Cotton Club. And we were talking about, well, wait a minute, there's a Harlem of the West. And so when we came back from that, we went downtown and we started doing work with the Augmented Reality in Harlem of the West and met with the San Diego History Center to talk about that and to show how it might work. But then it grew, it expanded into all these important aspects of the change in San Diego, not only Harlem of the West, but the area of La Jolla that you mentioned, the bifurcation of communities by the 805 and the 15, the fight against 252 in South Crest, the changing of Barkin Street to Martin Luther King Boulevard and then taking it down again. All those things are chronicled in the exhibit. And you can go to the exhibit, you can see all these communities, and you can see what had happened and experience one of those kinds of changes that made and what people did to protest these changes. But it does encompass all of those things. So it's a really good historical walk through San Diego's Black and Brown neighborhoods.
Well, and so that people know, where can they see this exhibit? And it's San Diego's Lost Neighborhoods,
that
I said
correct.
Last
yeah.
Before. So, but yes. Where can they find that?
Yeah, this is hosted at the San Diego History Center downtown in Balboa Park.
Okay, just to make sure. You know, I'm curious, what are some of the other neighborhoods that you talk about in San Diego's Lost Neighborhoods exhibit?
Yeah, we have Julian, South Crest, La Jolla, Gaslamp Quarter, Imperial Avenue, that's some of them.
Yeah. So what were some of the stories you folded into the Lost Neighborhoods exhibit that really stood out? I know you really spoke to community members about this.
Yeah, because I'm not grew up here, we really did rely on community members to have panel discussions and all the research because as we just started to work on just the idea of it, then we got together with UCSD students who, as their final exam, got involved in doing some of the research. And we were surprised at the amount of research and what was missing. That was the other thing. Because a lot of this information is gone. So we went through all the newspapers and all the TV stations and everything to try and gather this information. And we went to the neighborhoods, talked to people, got oral histories and all that. And some of that is part of the exhibit, especially through the augmented reality part. But that's how we kind of grew it. It started to be very complex, but very important.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine the oral histories is a really important part of that. Because sometimes our stories are not always told in publications or books.
When you talk to the people, for instance, who were dispersed by 805 going through Joyous Creek, whatever, I mean, these communities were devastated. I mean, right through the middle of it. But then, of course, there was also people fighting back when, for instance, in City Heights, where the 15 was going to go, and there's going to be like 8 blocks, but they got down to 1. They were going to 252 and was destroying that whole neighborhood, and they just totally got rid of that. So I'm proud of the communication, the people who fought back, but it did have its effect on relationships, families, everything like that. So it was very difficult for these communities to survive after the highways went through it.
Can I think of that, if you don't mind? The church was the key catalyst for trying to protect the infrastructure. I remember Reverend Lockridge, S.M. Lockridge, who was a well-known pastor here, along with Reverend Charles Hampton from Bethel Baptist Church. And Martin Luther King came here, and they hosted Dr. Martin Luther King here. And that was a tremendous thing. I remember my mother talking about it, and she actually went when they had this gathering. But people didn't know that these prolific leaders, I mean, no one knew this history. Robert Kennedy was the night he got shot. We saw him the night he got shot. Bethel Baptist Church was at 28th and Clay. He came to 29th and Clay for a quick minute because he had to go up to the L.A. to the ambassador, and we snuck out of church that night to go see him. But a lot of the stories you're talking about reside with the old black families in those churches, because if there are not many of them left anymore, and even a lot of those churches have unfortunately been dispersed. But there's a rich history through the black church in San Diego. And there's still some of them out there, but of those folks, again, are getting older and older. But that would be something I think would be tremendous. I also, regarding UCSD, when they had Black History Month, when mm-hmm. I taught there, I remember going, I didn't even know where the exhibit was. I happened to go downstairs to go check out something in technology, and they had this exhibit for blacks in La Jolla. Mm-hmm. And the curator was there, and I was looking. She goes, "Oh, you like the exhibit?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "There's my dad. There's my uncle. There's my grandmother." And she looked at me like what? Like, yeah. And I was like, "Yeah, those are my family and relatives and friends I grew up with." You know,
same thing happens at the exhibit. When we're at the exhibit, when people are walking through, they go, "Oh, there's so and so, and there's so, and there's my friend." Oh, wow, I saw so and so, and there's so. A lot of that happens when you go and see the exhibit.
Nice. Yeah, it's special. It's just amazing. I wish the younger people. This is where a lot of it gets lost. Is that the young. You know, having young people who have a sense of an identity of and pride in the black history of San Diego is, you know, part of it needs to be taught. And we don't, you know, because if we're not taught, we don't know. And if we leave things out of history, even the history we're taught, even in our communities, mm-hmm. then we do a disservice to our kids because they don't have any black consciousness because they don't see it and they don't understand it and how to have that sense of pride.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because you get questions about what to do and where to go and what's, and so I'm so happy that we have Black San Diego here because finally you can tell people what to do and where to go.
Yeah. Because, Cherie, I mean, do you feel like, you know, the sense of black identity and community in San Diego has become diluted or less connected?
I think that if you're not from here, then yes. I think that's why me and my business partner, Tanisha, started Black San Diego, is because being a native of San Diego, you know where to go. You know some of the history. You know a lot more than if you're just come here. It's not like you go to Atlanta and you're like, I know I can go down this street and see black people. I know I can go to this neighborhood. So when you come to San Diego, you're like, where are the black people? Where's the black culture? Where's the history? Like, you guys have no history, no nothing. And it's like, we do. And so that's why Black San Diego comes into play of like, hey, go to the museum and see what exactly is going on. Or hey, go to this event and learn a little bit more. We just did a segment with Yasmin from Channel 10 News. And she just said, we talked about that we found a directory from the 1960s, mm-hmm. and it had 200 Black-owned businesses within a two-mile radius. And a lot of people didn't even know that that even existed. And so I think it's important that we constantly have those conversations and put them out there, so mm-hmm. that way people know that, hey, like, we had this. Like, how can we rebuild it but look a little differently?
Well, we're going to answer that question on the other side of this break. We're continuing the conversation about efforts to build an even greater sense of Black community in 2025. Midday Edition is back after the break.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
Welcome back. Thanks for sticking around, too. This is KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Jade Hindman. So we're talking about the disappearance and displacement of San Diego's once thriving Black community and efforts to revitalize it. I'm here with Rick Epps, political science professor at Imperial Valley College, along with Gaidi Finney, executive director at the San Diego African American Museum of Fine Art, and Cherie Jones, founder of the nonprofit Black San Diego. Welcome back again to you all. Cherie, to pick up where we left off, I mean, your group, Black San Diego, puts together a lot of events to help people connect in the community. So how did it all get started?
So back in 2015, actually, the other founders, Tanisha, she made a Facebook post and was like, where are the Black-owned businesses? At that time, I was just getting fresh into real estate, and I was trying to grow my business. And I remember going to an event that I would be the only one in there, and I felt away. I felt like I had to be somebody different. I felt like I had to beg for a seat at the table. So I told her I had this idea that I wanted to put together an event for our community, because if I felt this way, other people probably felt this way too. So we're going to have one event. It was going to be a networking event. We had over 100 people show up, and they said, you got to keep going. So here we are 9 years later, and we just kept it going, and it has grew to this thing that we didn't even know was going to grow into, and it works, and it just really brings our community together. We don't have a Black neighborhood, so we essentially created an online Black neighborhood.
That's very interesting. Yeah, Rick, and you hear that, and you're like, wow.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, that's fascinating. That's so wonderful to hear in the younger generation trying to bring back a sense of history to the Black community here and to the young people particularly, because they need They don't even know they need it, but they need it. No.
Well, and Cherie, I'm curious because I want to know more. I mean, what are some of the events that you've put on so far, or what's coming up?
So we do 4 networking events for the year. So we do 1 a quarter to bring a lot of value. We also do our yearly event called Dago Eats, which is during Black History Month in February. So that will be our next event that's coming up. Save the Date will be coming out soon. But that is an event where it's kind of almost like in Candle Street Fair. Mm-hmm. And so we have over 50 vendors that come in. It's food. You pretty much can buy any and everything Black. We have all Black vendors. You can come in there and you just bring a chair, you just prop up and you spend the whole entire day with us. We have a kids corner, a jumper, face painting. All the kids corner stuff is free, and it really is just about taking whatever we did online and just putting it in person for a day, getting people offline pretty much. And then we have our B6 program, which really supports Black-owned businesses. We noticed during COVID a lot of people could not get grant or funding or anything because they didn't have the proper paperwork. So we essentially help business owners in the community get exactly what they need.
Yeah. Well, and back to my initial question of where can you find a good plate of soul food? You might just find it at Dago Eats.
You can find it at Dago Eats. We have everybody there. Everyone that you ever probably wanted to taste and didn't get a chance to go, they are always there.
Uh-huh. I attended. It was fantastic.
Yes, thank you.
I mean, you know, have you seen the sense of community and cultural connectedness really grow as a result of this online community? And do you have any, like, maybe personal stories about that?
I definitely have seen it. I feel like it brings us, like, together. It lets us know what's actually going on in the community. I think that being a military town and a very transient town where people are constantly going in and out, they come here, like, where can I get a haircut? Where can I take my kid for daycare? Where are the best schools with diversity? So you see one extreme to the next. But I think that just seeing those things happening, it really makes... We don't get paid from this. So it really makes our heart, it's a labor of love. Mm-hmm. And it really makes us feel good that we're able to do something for not just the community, but like our community. And personal stories, there are so many. People will like run up to us and be like, aren't you Miss Black San Diego? I'm like, my name is Sheree, yes. But they're like, man, my business grew just because of you. And we do a survey every year for the business owners. And these business owners are making like six figures easily just by being connected to the page.
Bravo.
So that is really important for us to get them from the hustle business to just actually a business that's thriving.
Yeah. Well, Gaidi, the San Diego African American Museum of Fine Art has done so much to help preserve our art and history and cultural identity. Talk a bit about why that's so important.
It's probably the most important. We find that the culture has been less and less, if you will. When I first got here in 93, for instance, there was Black radio station, and a lot of that is just not there anymore. And so the museum and our board, we want to bring the best of art and culture to San Diego. And that's been that's what we want to do, is to bring the best that we can, the best art, the best music like that. Mm-hmm. And also we are managers of what's called the Black Cultural District. The city has designated that area, 9 blocks on Imperial, as the Black Cultural District with the museum as manager. But we have a committee of community members who guide that and give and advise how things will happen there. And so that's really working out well. We're into our third year of that, and a lot more to come. That's going to be, I call it Tony to Tiger. Great. Great. We're going to do wonderful things. And it started to be great already.
I love
that. That's exciting. Wow. That's awesome.
And so tell me, I mean, what are you working on next?
We have a number of things, both locally and internationally.
Oh, okay.
Locally, we're coming up. We have two exhibits up right now, one called the Clothing Store at Mesa College. And we have another one, as I just mentioned, with the Lost Neighborhoods at San Diego History Center. We also have coming up our Keepers of the Culture, where we honor those people who've kept Black culture alive. I think you've hosted that once for us.
Yes.
That's in February as well. We have done an annual music fest that we do, and a number of other exhibits that are about to come up.
All right. Well, you know, the exhibit we spoke about, San Diego's Lost Neighborhoods, it really tells the story of resilience. And I'm curious how you all are thinking about the resilience of San Diego's Black community, especially right now. Rick?
You know, it's interesting because it is so diluted, right? And I think the last remnant is kind of off Kelton Road, up on the hill there, right? Mm-hmm. I still have a lot of friends that live up there. And off Logan Avenue, there's still a few. But you see it happening. I'm going to use the Black church again, because I've seen this resilience in the Black church of trying to create a sense of community and really trying to modernize the Black experience. I think the history is the most essential part, but figuring out what it means to be Black in San Diego in 2025 and what that looks like going forward. How do we grow ourselves, especially in the midst of such tremendous economic pressures, the cost, you know, what's driving people away, the cost of living, you know, it's not affordable. That's why a lot of Black families left the scene and went, you know, wherever they went, whether it's on Riverside and Las Vegas and different places. But I think that's the idea of what both of you have done is really, to me, the essential part of this resurgence, this reawakening of San Diego. And how do we get that message out further? Even at places like San Diego State, I taught here 22 years, and you know, I took it upon myself, knowing I was the only Black faculty a lot of these students would ever see, to try to enlighten them, you know, in my chapters on civil rights and civil liberties, on the inequities of not just black folks, but, you know, with other groups too. So, you know, in terms of how we incorporate, I think resilience comes from what you all are doing. I think getting them politically reawakened is really important. So maybe part of the dialogues means having people like myself or others who are in the political know to be able to help, you know, get people to understand what the real issues are and explain to them why they need to get out and vote. Because typically, you know, we're not good at voting so well. So being able to get people to be the drivers of their own reality, that's how you bring pressure to bear on the people who make decisions every day about your viability.
Well, Rick, let me ask you this, because in the past, one of the factors that's sort of dispersed the black community are policy decisions that have been made. Do you see any at the forefront right now that San Diego's black community should really be focused on?
Well, this gerrymandering, this even with Prop 50, this whole issue about, you know, again, has a lot to do with carving up communities to be able to give the predominant voting power to a particular demographic. So for the black community, it's really assessing where black folks are, right? Where are we residing in numbers that have significance? And then in the process of that, saying, okay, so is this an area that's being attacked? So we can figure out how to fight back in those neighborhoods where we see where we have significant black influence that are being minimized because the way the politics are set up. And then also holding city council accountable. You know, it's an accountability thing for the people who represent us in this district. You know, the guy, Leon Williams, who was the first black city council member in San Diego in 69, and then George Stevens, who was another city council member. These people worked hard in their communities to kind of get them politically awakened. Mm-hmm. We need to do that again, and we need to make sure that we protect and really educate those areas to really get the young people and the people who are responsible in those communities to see themselves as being a vital part and to hold on to their bit of, for lack of a better word, their bit of power and influence in those communities. That's what I would suggest.
Yeah. Well, Gaidi, what are your thoughts? I mean, how are you thinking about the resilience of San Diego's black community?
I just think that you just have to have good community participation. Make sure you talk with your politicians, and as you just mentioned, and to be aware of some. And when you mentioned 50, mm-hmm. I mean that could really affect us without. So you need to have knowledge of what's going on. You can't put your head in the sand these days because too much is going on when you wake up every morning. Mm-hmm. So you just need to be aware and be very communicating and pay attention to Black San Diego.
Exactly, because this is where it's at now, Cherie. And I mean, what do you think can be done to pass the torch to the next generation? Because you've really kind of picked up the baton here and created this online community. So what do you think can be done to sort of keep this momentum going?
Definitely like what both of them said, we definitely need to continue having conversations and letting people, making people aware of exactly what's going on, what the history is, so that way it doesn't repeat itself, that we do a lot better. I think the political aspect is key, putting the right people in office. I live in the 4th district and I know that it's getting sticky right now and I'm just paying attention to it. But I think the people that are in those leadership positions need to pay attention to understand that we're also looking at how they're conducting themselves and carrying themselves. I think the real estate aspect is key as well. I think just being a real estate broker, I see everybody just so quick to sell their grandparents' house and like leave. Or, you know, like you said, it's getting too expensive, or they don't know what they don't know, and I don't have a trust, so I'm going to probate. And so those are things that I like to talk about because I think all of those things are really important, and they all go hand in hand, so that way it's not like, well, I have to leave because I can't afford it, mm-hmm. or I don't know anything, I have to go. So I think those are just conversations that we have to continue having with everyone.
Especially the other part of that in conjunction is the lack of viable financing for home ownership here. There are glass doors for people of color, particularly African American, when you go to want to finance a home, that are very subtle but are very much directed there. And that's also part of this equation that people don't talk about. And it's so significant in terms of this process and trying to hold on to and have people not run away from the city because it's too expensive, is how do we provide a mechanism for people to be able to still afford to stay here and have a comfortable life when the cost of living is exorbitant. My parents' house over, which is on the border of Lemon Grove and Cano, right there in that border, you couldn't touch it for under almost $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
how do you even get started? Like, it's just insane what we've created. But part of that infrastructure is what is causing the dissolution of the Black community in our city. So,
well, Cherie, you touched on something really important, I think, and that's you know, home ownership and being able to pass family wealth through real estate down to the next generation. What advice would you give someone who's got a house in their family? What steps do they need to take in order to be able to pass that down?
Definitely start with a trust. If a trust is out of reach, definitely look at like a transferred upon deed or death upon transfer. That means that when they pass, the deed will go to the next kin or whoever they designate from there. But I think it also too was like we're missing the family meeting. A lot of times people aren't having those conversations with their family. And so when they pass, it's everybody's fighting at that point. And it's like it doesn't have to be that way. So I think it is starting with a trust, sitting down with somebody that you trust, an attorney, and getting it all worked out, and then have a conversation with your family of, when I pass, this is what I want. I don't want you guys to fight. This is how I'm setting it up. And I feel like that will eliminate a lot of things from there.
Can I also add to that that mm-hmm. I can't tell you the number of Black families. My grandparents, my mother's parents were in Pacific Beach in a little Black community that was right there. And I can tell you that half the families in that community died and the state took everything mm-hmm. because a lot of Black folks don't have any understanding of the process of being able to mm-hmm. hand your property off. And they just, or, you know, all the misinformation or all the things they've got in their head, mm-hmm. lack of knowledge. And then all of a sudden it's gone and it is gone to the state instead mm-hmm. of, you know, either providing it as a mechanism to another, someone else in the Black community.
Mm-hmm. Well, so a quick fire round before we close out. What's keeping you hopeful about the community, Gaiety?
Oh, I just think there's some beautiful things that are happening. I mean, just even this conversation helps. But as I look around and I see some things that we're doing and other organizations are doing, I'm hopeful.
All right. Cherie?
The same. I think just being around like the community and just the leaders in the community and see what they're doing and supporting their efforts, I think that is, like you said, like beautiful, and I'm glad to be a part of it.
All right. Rick?
Yeah, I agree. Like being here, like really, I just feel uplifted sitting here listening to both of you. Seriously, I feel very honored because I had never met either one of you, and just hearing these things that, you know, it's you get busy in your life and you don't, and all of a sudden you're going, wow, they have this? Really, this is going on there? Mm-hmm. So I think that that's really an essential part of it. I also think that getting other people who don't look like us exposed to us so they learn that, you know, their ignorance or their stereotypes of how they perceive the Black community can be diminished by virtue of their experiences, and letting them come in and say, hey, come and try our soul food. Come and hear what we do and see what we do and experience that, I think is the essence of and richness of it, to see the diversity that we all represent in our experiences. I think that's where, that's my hope, and, you know, getting the young people more inspired and having a sense of pride is where I would love to see this mature and grow.
One of the things that I'm proud of is we're part of the diaspora as well. We, that exhibit that I talked about in New York opened on August 15th in Harlem, the Harlem Walk of Honor.
We got to leave it there because we got to wrap. I thank you all so much. We can always continue this conversation. I've been speaking with Rick Epps, political science professor at Imperial Valley College, Gaiety Finney, executive director at the San Diego African American Museum of Fine Art, and Cherie Jones, founder of the nonprofit Black San Diego. And you all, thank you so much for joining. If you missed anything, you can download KPBS Midday Edition on all podcast apps. I'm Jade Hindman. We'll talk again tomorrow. Until then, make it a great day on purpose, everyone.
The Cartober fundraising drive is on. Help give back this month by donating your used car, truck, RV, or boat to KPBS. Donating is easy and it's tax deductible. Learn more by visiting us at kpbs.org/car.